Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
Mana from the heavens, Nate.
Not that kind of mana.
Oh, okay. Different kind of mana we're talking about. We're talking about the new recording from Kalia Vandiver, and they have a series of great records. Something about their music, Nate, really does strike me, and it sounds goofy to use all the words, or maybe trite in some sense, to use all the words that I can't help but use, and that when I hear their music, I think of meditative things, and I think of sort of being immersed in some aspect of their sound. And also, I am hearing trombones and layered effects and ultimately beautiful compositions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is par for the course in some ways. How do you think this is a distinctive work based upon what they've already done, which are a couple of great records?
Well, this is not the first solo trombone and electronics album in the Kalia Vandiver, you know, body of work, but it is the first in which they're singing.
Ah.
And so it's a vocal debut.
Got it.
I think it's a very successful one because there are songs on this album that really work as songs. You know, the lyrics are mostly pretty direct. It's not a ton of frou-frou, metaphorical, lyrical stuff. It's like, it's pretty emotionally clear. And we talked about that in our conversation. But that feeling that you alluded to, I think, is really integral. This sense of something immersive, something sort of emotionally transparent and calming, you know, soothing.
Yeah, there's, this is tricky space sometimes because you can put this in a category that sounds like a pejorative for some, which is wellness.
Mm-hmm.
But it has those aspects of calming. And maybe it's a great antidote to everything else around us in this world to hear something that is clear and very focused. And I think Kalia has a gift, and I'm glad they've figured it out in some ways and sharing it with us.
It's important to note there's a real focused musicality in all of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and this is what I think differentiates this album from, for instance, the Andre 3000 album,
right,
which is a little bit more noodly, meandery, right? Kalia really approaches these compositions with a clear arc and a sense of execution. You know, it's like, these are like etudes in a certain way, you know, and it's not about the technical virtuosity, although what they're doing does require quite a bit of control.
Yeah.
It's about a kind of thematic wholeness or unity. So I think it's a really accomplished album. And I have to say, after our conversation, I got to see the performance of this work, and it was riveting. The audience at Solar Myth was fully along for the ride, and it was a very, very cool thing to see and to experience in that space.
I'm also fascinated to hear what you talk about related to Hawaii, because you both have that connection.
Yes, that's where we begin.
All right.
So, why don't we take the journey?
Begin.
We'll take the Trans-Pacific journey now. I'm envious because Kalia actually got to do that shortly after this engagement and went out to Honolulu for an artist residency. Nice work if you can get it. But the inspiration of the islands and specifically Native Hawaiian mythology and folklore and sort of spiritual concerns, like that's all here and present in this album as well. So without further ado, this is Kalia Vandiver and myself on stage at Solar Myth in June of 2026. Kalia Vandiver, welcome to the Late Set and welcome to Philadelphia.
Hi, Nate. How are you doing?
Good, good. How are you feeling today as you roll into Solar Myth on this unseasonably warm, sort of pre-summer but deep summer day?
Well, yeah, I feel quite sweaty, but I feel happy to be here. Today's the release of my album, Mana, so it feels like a celebratory day, but I've also kind of been in motion for most of the day. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to settle somewhere. I feel like this is the first time of the day that I have settled.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to play later too.
Congratulations on the release of this album. It is gorgeous. It feels like a statement, you know, it feels like a really significant new chapter for you. And I've been excited to talk about it since I first heard it. And so we've talked a little bit before about solo performance and ambient performance, and you've done this before, but what's different about this one, there's a few things, right? One is the inspiration, the explicit source of inspiration. So let's begin there. This interests me, of course, as someone who grew up in Hawaii, but Mana, for our audience, why don't you explain what mana is, what it means, and why it spoke and speaks to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so mana is the divine and supernatural spirit that once only lived in gods and deities in Hawaii, but in modern culture, it's believed that mana is something that you can cultivate and access the deeper you become in your ancestry and your land and also self, sense of self. And it's a term that I came across last year when I was in Hawaii. And I've had more opportunities to go to Hawaii in the last couple of years, not only for family reasons, but also for work, which has been really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time I played the solo set in Hawaii, it was really overwhelming. Yeah, because most of my mother's side of the family is from there, Hawaii or the Philippines. And the first time I played there, my whole extended family came to the show, and it wasn't really something that I was expecting could happen in my career. A lot of the solo music has been inspired by Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian mythology and finding closeness with those who have passed and having experiences of that while being in Hawaii. But it's also something that I think about when I perform. So like just performing it in Hawaii and having that while with my family in the audience was really surreal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The family resonance and then the sort of spirit resonance of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that people from Hawaii really intuitively understand. And then it sounds very weird when you talk about it with people outside of it, but the Native Hawaiian belief system, nothing is more powerful than the land itself,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And mana, it's spiritual power,
mm-hmm.
and it emanates from sacred spaces, right? And I wonder if you have any stories to tell about feeling that power, sensing it during your time there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one experience that I've talked about in my live performance before, which is visiting the islands after my grandfather passed and going to this waterfall called Manawili Falls on Oahu. And yeah, it was probably like 6 months or so after my grandfather passed. And I was already thinking of like ways that I could stay connected with him even after his passing or if there were any signs. And it was kind of, it was really unexpected, but I went on this hike to the waterfall and felt this presence and felt a presence around me, both like just in my body, but also my surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt kind of like a hello from him. And that was the first time that I experienced that sort of power of the islands. And it's a time where I really needed it too.
Mm-hmm. I did not know this until recently, like maybe a week or two ago, but preparing for this conversation, I discovered that your mother at one point was a Polynesian dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Wow. Did I wonder where I talked about that.
It was some other interview from probably years ago.
Yeah. So she, in Southern California, she was in a Polynesian dance group from high school through her early 20s. And she was really good too. She was an incredible dancer. But I think it was a path that she didn't want to pursue long term and like into her adulthood. I think for her, it felt, she felt stuck in that world, even though she was really talented. But it was a really insular world, and I think she wanted more.
Do you have childhood memories of those rhythms? Because so much, when I think about Polynesian dancing, and I grew up in that environment myself, and I've seen countless hours of it, and I have family that's involved in it, and, you know, and maybe this says more about me, but the thing that I always think about is the rhythmic articulation. And I wonder if that's something that you have a connection to as well.
Yeah. When my sister and I were younger, we would go see performances done by this company. My mom was no longer dancing with them, but we were still connected to the family who ran the company. So we would go see it, and we had friends who would dance and drum in the ensemble. And it's interesting. I was playing trombone at the time, but I was playing like mostly classical music, and then I would step into this world and be really excited by what was happening. And I think once I started playing jazz, I'm sure it just kind of naturally seeped into the musical world that I was finding myself in. And I think probably naturally was influenced by it.
Yeah. Anyone who ever goes to a luau, you know, you'll have the experience of seeing a young man walk up with a conch shell and blast this beautiful single tone. And it occurs to me that the register of the conch shell, I mean, it is kind of in dialogue with trombone, you know? And of course, Steve Turay made that connection sort of a part of his identity. But it, like, is that another sound that you carry with you?
Not the conch shell specifically, but something that came to mind that we had around the house, going back to rhythm, was an ipu, the gourd. And my mom, from a young age, showed me how to play it. And it's something that I would pick up around the house a lot. I think I played with that more than I played with conch shells.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a similarity in register and timbre with the trombone.
So I want to talk about this album, but first, because this is so fascinating and I feel like we have to sort of untangle it, you and I had a previous conversation for the Slate podcast Working, and it was about the experience you had kind of pulling together your solo ambient practice in the midst of being on tour with Harry Styles. And it was like, on one level, these seemed like the most diametrically opposed sort of musical expressions. You know, like one is like playing stadiums to 40,000, 50,000 screaming fans. And then the other was like deeply interior, very quiet, very meditative. But you made the point that like it all made sense together for you. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. I learned so much playing with him and playing in those spaces, and mainly learning about different kinds of performance and how a performance on that scale has so much to do with, you know, of course the music, but like also how you carry yourself and how you engage with an audience. And there's a lot I learned about like engagement and presence and projecting and how the instrument feels and how I can be comfortable in my body and in the instrument when I'm playing to an audience that's screaming the whole time. And it is also a practice of mindfulness, which is something that the solo project kind of forces me to tap into, is being mindful and being calm and knowing how my body feels that day and how it may affect the performance. Because, yeah, we played so many shows, and I remember we were playing in Europe in the summer, and a lot of these places were outside, and it was humid, and I'm playing a brass instrument, and I'm struggling, and I have to keep it together. And I think that sort of physical and mental challenge is something that I hadn't experienced before. Mm-hmm. There was kind of no way of preparing for that kind of performance. And I think getting over that and like experiencing those nerves and experiencing kind of jumping into something of that magnitude prepared me for now any situation ever. And I've played the solo set in a lot of different settings and different situations where like, yeah, maybe I can't hear myself so well, or it's like really hot outside, or I'm not feeling well and like the instrument doesn't feel well, or my voice isn't feeling well. And it's like, okay, how do I adjust, and how can I still remain present in the performance? Mm-hmm. And around the same time, I was meeting with Jen Hsu as part of this mentorship program. And most of our meetings had to do with presence. And she came to a show of mine and was like taking notes the whole time. And I was like, wow, I wonder how she feels about the show. And it all had to do with like, yeah, my stage presence and like engaging with an audience. And I feel like from our conversations and then the experience of touring with Harry and playing those shows really kind of informed how I engage both with the solo music in performance and also how I engage with an audience.
Mm-hmm. I had sort of forgotten that Jen had been assigned to you as a mentor, and yeah, the depth of her understanding. I think of Jen as the ultimate performance artist. She really brings so much to that practice. And so it makes a lot of sense that you would get a lot out of that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned so much from her that kind of goes beyond the music that I'm creating, but more so just how I want to approach performance and continuously change kind of, or not change, but like bring new elements into the performance.
Yeah. Now, I know that Harry Styles has been very generous in pointing people towards your music and your name as an artist. You've also worked with Japanese Breakfast, been on tour, been on TV. But it was really another artist, a singer-songwriter, Hayley Hendricks, that is the most sort of relevant in terms of this project, right? Yeah. Can we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, so I toured with Hayley now a couple of years ago on two tours, I believe, or two or three actually tours, and I was opening for her. And I had played opening sets before and opened for songwriters, but not on a tour and for an audience that is very specific. Like Haley's audience is, you know, they know all of her lyrics. They know all of her songs. I mean, I think any Hayley fan really resonates with her songs and her lyricism, and you really remember the stories. And going into the first tour, I wasn't singing as much in the set as I am now, but I was thinking of how can I relate this music to an audience? And maybe I was thinking about it a little too much, you know, because like it was primarily instrumental at the time, maybe a couple songs I sang. And that's when I started talking during the set more and like, yeah, talking about the feeling that it evokes for me and even maybe like suggesting something that they could think about. And that really resonated with them. And I think they really listened to what I was saying and listened to the set as well and really had like insightful things to say afterwards. And it showed me that even if I play a fully instrumental set, the feeling that I'm trying to create comes across to an audience.
Yeah.
Even to an audience who isn't used to hearing that kind of music.
Thank you.
there's quite a bit of vocals on Mana. One thing that is really striking to me is in the same way that you hear Louis Armstrong sing and it sounds like his trumpet playing, I feel like your singing has a lot of the same properties that I associate with your trombone playing. I mean, there's purity of tone and just unerring long form breath control. And it's just, it's very unwavering. It's very personal. And so I wonder, was that a challenge for you to step into that role, or did it feel as natural as when you play on your instrument?
I think at first when I began singing during the set, it felt unnatural because I'm so used to having the trombone in front of me. And so then I would put it down and it's just me and a microphone. And I think that was scariest for me. It was just not having a barrier between me and an audience. Now I feel like I have kind of a sense of focus and intention behind singing. And it feels very fluid with my trombone playing. So I think it's easier now to go between the two. And that's kind of how I see the relationship even on the album. Like, I think someone asked me, like, how do you think of like the call and response between the trombone and voice? And it really doesn't feel like that at all for me. It feels like
it's holistic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lyrically, there's a directness in some of these songs. Really, most of them, I would say. I think of a song, and I hope I get the title right. Is it Your Fault? Mm-hmm. So this song, Your Fault, sounds like dialogue from like a family table or something, you know, or it's like, it's your fault that I'm like this, you know, why am I like this? Mm-hmm. Is that something that comes out of, I mean, I hate the word confessional as it applies to singer-songwriters, but like, is this sort of something that you felt was something that you had to share, or are you creating vignettes? Like, what is the impetus there?
Yeah. So when I wrote this song, it started with the loop and I was playing with words and playing with this angst that comes across in the song. I was talking to friends the other night about the songs on the album with words. There's a few songs that have the sense of longing and hope, and then there are like a couple that are really angsty, and this is one of them. And while it is personal, it also feels like a character that I'm stepping into. And it's like making this experience and reflecting on my trajectory personally and making that experience and making that period of time and that learning as a character.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I view that song.
It's your fault.
The song that ends the album is called Holding. And it's funny, on your previous album, which we haven't talked about yet, but your previous album is a quartet record with Mary Halverson and Kayvon Martin and Kanoa Mendenhall. There's a song on that album called Withholding. And on this one, it's Holding. And I'm struck by the way in which that word shapeshifts in the course of your lyrics. You think about holding as something that is comforting, cradling, like an embrace, but then you also think of it like a holding cell, the constriction of that.
Yeah.
And there are moments in this song where you ask, and I might misquote this, but will you
release?
Yeah, will you hold me, and then will you release me? Right. What can we take from that sort of the multiplicity of that word in that song?
I think for me, I was considering the ways in which I'm very sentimental and very nostalgic, and how that's a beautiful thing to carry with me, but it's also a challenge because I can find myself like really living in this world or this narrative that is no longer my story, mm-hmm. and that's okay. And trying to find peace in the letting go. And if it involves two people, you know, like in the case of this song, I was writing about a person and considering that moment when you can finally sense that person also letting go, mm-hmm. and how to accept that. And yeah, I love, I don't play that song every set. I feel like it's one that I have to be in the mood for.
Mm-hmm. Bjork fan?
Yeah, I am.
So there, this, and this for me is a definitely a compliment, but like that song in particular, it puts me in that place, mm-hmm. where Bjork has this ability to, like, she'll be working with very fundamental harmony, almost ancient harmony, mm-hmm. and then sometimes her language is very poetic, and sometimes it's like as straightforward as it comes, you know, yeah. and she'll say something that's like, wow, like she just came out and said it.
You know? Totally, yeah.
And so there's something about the way that the elements move in that song that I was like, oh, what is this reminding me of? That's probably Bjork, that's it.
Yeah, I've listened to a lot of Bjork, so it only makes sense that she comes through.
Yeah. Mm. Now in live performance, how does it come alive in a different way for you? Mm. Or was this album... Because my understanding is that this album is more performed than produced. So, I mean, is it really just the same, more of the same, or does it have a different resonance for you?
Mm. The solo set, especially some of the two solo records that are now out, I recorded in a house, and it was important for me to be really comfortable mm-hmm. when recording the music because it feels so intimate. And I think in general, when I record, I want to capture the same element of performance as a live performance. And, you know, at the beginning of the solo project, a lot of it was improvised. And so there was that element was captured in the recording, which I loved. And then coming to this record, I'm like, okay, most of these are songs. There's like two pieces that are improvised on the record, but otherwise I had written these songs. But I didn't want it to entirely feel that way. Like I still wanted there to be this like patience and development of an idea on the more song-based pieces. So I guess I was coming to it in a performance mindset, even though like we were in a house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This album is on International Anthem, and it's your first for them, right? I was thinking about this, the connotations of a label home, because listening to Mana at one point, I was thinking like, what if this album were on ECM, which it could have been, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I just picture the different sort of feeling that I have if I'm imagining you performing this in a cathedral in Oslo, yeah. instead of, I think you recorded it in Florida, right? Or
I wrote it in Florida, and then I came back to New York and recorded it at my friend's house upstate. Yeah,
but it has a particular, it sort of comes into the world a certain way on the International Anthem label. This is a place that has cultivated Carlos Nino, and there's all this like beautiful meditative music that you could call it ambient, you could call it spiritual. There's lots of different terms. And so what does that mean to you? What is it? What is the significance of this music living on this particular label?
Yeah, it feels very significant to me because International Anthem is a label that I had been following for some time, and they're home to a lot of artists who I am either friends with or folks who I've been listening to for years. And I noticed the way that they really foster community with their artists and amongst the team as well. And that's very noticeable, just the way that their ethos as a label. And when I started meeting their team, like I met someone on their team for the first time at Big Ears Festival, like a couple of years ago. And it was so nice. And it had some to do with my music, but it also just had to do with like us as people and, you know, what we're interested in and what we've been thinking about. And it felt important to them to get to know me as a person and beyond my music. And, you know, they like my music, but yeah, it really felt supportive from the beginning of mm-hmm. developing a relationship with them. And throughout this entire process, they've really made me feel comfortable and confident to express myself and express this music in the way that I want to. I've had experiences, not many, but where you create a body of work and it's really important to you and you send it somewhere and maybe some of it doesn't resonate with them, or there's like a song that doesn't resonate with them, and they loved the album in its entirety. And every other creative decision that needed to be made, like they were really supportive. So I just feel thankful both that it exists in that musical world, but also that I'm a part of this community now.
Yeah. There are people who will pick up any release from this label.
Yeah.
And not really worry about where it fits on the genre spectrum. You know, it's kind of like we understand that improvisation is generally centered, you know, but yeah. Like, is it jazz? Like that's not really the concern most of the time, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Which I love about them too. Cause I come from a jazz background and I have put out records that maybe lean more in a jazz direction, but with the solo project, I'm a little wary to label exclusively as jazz. Yeah. Like it does feel more ambient. And of course there's jazz elements because it's improvisational, and that music means a lot to me, but I think I've struggled sometimes with being pigeonholed as a jazz artist, and it's sometimes impossible to get out of that in any genre. But yeah, it feels right that it came out with them, because it's hard to define most of the artists
right
who are on that label.
Yeah. And with Mana, it's like, well, you know, is it a singer-songwriter record? I guess, you know, yeah. Is it an ambient record? Sure. Like yeah. it's not really, I mean, you know, you could try to apply modifiers, but that's not really the point. Right. But I do want to ask whether and how your delving into this solo practice and really getting comfortable with it and sort of creating permutations on it, all of that, how does that feed into your other side as a composer band leader? What's that exchange like?
Oh, well, now it's so nice when I go back to playing with my band, because I feel like the way that I approach soloing is way more patient now. I can really take my time when I'm playing with an ensemble. You know, like my composition is slightly different for quartet. It's like there's still a lot of like cyclical elements and playing with maybe an individual theme over the course of one song, and finding like subtle variations over the course of that song as an ensemble, but also like in my own playing. And I've noticed like if I'm coming off a stream of a lot of solo shows and I go back to the quartet, I really can like settle into my playing mm-hmm. in a really nice way. Yeah, I'm trying to think of my last album, Another View, that came out in the fall last year, we played two shows. We played like an LA show and a release show in New York. And I feel like I brought this other kind of side of my playing to the quartet. And I think that is a product of playing solo mm-hmm. a lot of the time now.
Yeah, I wonder if it's almost somebody who shows up for whatever they're doing and someone's, oh, you feel a little different. And it's, yeah, I've been meditating or, you know, yeah, whatever. Like, I've been really centered, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's probably both, like, yeah, the fact that I, yeah, for the solo set, I do have to be very centered, but I'm also just so excited to, like, play with other people.
Yeah.
Because I still love collaboration, mm-hmm, you know, and I still love improvising with other musicians. And so now when I step back into that music, it's so fun and I'm genuinely so excited to play with other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nate.
Our valiant audience, thank you for being here.
Nate Chenin and Kalia Vandiver from Solar Myth in Philadelphia here on The Late Set from WRTI. Nate, it sounded like the two of you got along fabulously.
Yeah, we had some fun.
Yeah, and looking forward to hearing more work from them in the future. I think we're 3 albums in now?
I think more than that.
Okay, well, I need to catch up then. Well, speaking of catching up, I always try to catch up to you and your many things that you are digging. So if you would, for our segment, Nate, This I Dig. What do you got?
All right, I've got a two-parter. First, briefly, I have already endorsed this album on NPR Music's New Music Friday in late June. But because this is our Kalia Vandiver episode, I feel like I should probably sort of signal boost this thing again. The pianist Micah Thomas put out a record called Lucid, and it features Kalia as well as Emmanuel Wilkins and Leslie Mock and Thomas Morgan. And it's sort of an avant-garde chamber album. It's beautiful and sparse. And, you know, when you think about free improvisation and, you know, the techniques that are adjacent to it, I think a lot of people think about frenetic or chaotic expression, you know, like something that's really bristly and
jarring.
Yeah, right. This is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent, you know, when you think about abstraction, it's the equivalent of walking into the gallery at a contemporary art museum and looking at a canvas, you know? It has that kind of quiet presence, but it's beautifully played. And I think Kalia's trombone playing on this album in particular is worth calling out because it's something very different from what we hear on Mana.
Yeah.
And the interaction with Emmanuel and with Micah, I mean, it's really first rate. If you don't mind, I've got one more. So, Josh, you probably don't have this on your calendar, but for me, it's a big deal. A little later this month, on July 17th, there's a movie opening called The Odyssey.
The Odyssey.
This is the new Christopher Nolan joint, and
okay,
it's based on a pretty old story.
Oh, we're talking Telemachus and
stuff?
We're
talking Telemachus. We're talking, you know, the trials of Odysseus and his effort to,
okay,
to try to get home, buffeted by the forces of nature and the gods.
And the love of Penelope.
There you go. So I cannot endorse this movie yet because I haven't seen it. I'm very excited about it. But what I can endorse is the translation of the Odyssey by a Penn professor named Emily Wilson. And this has, you know, it's been duly celebrated, and Emily Wilson has since translated the Iliad, also to great acclaim.
Okay.
But I'm endorsing it because in preparation for the Christopher Nolan movie, I've been rereading Emily Wilson's translation. This is my third translation of the Odyssey.
I was going to say, I'm so old that I don't even know who did mine.
I think when I was in high school, I read the Robert Fitzgerald. And then, I'm forgetting his name, but there was another one that I read about a decade ago. But Emily's is, it's a really, really striking translation, and she makes certain decisions that are quite academically sound. They're rooted in an understanding of the language and the time period, but it is stripped of a lot of the sort of highfalutin Anglophile, you know, accoutrement that were typical to translations past. So she really delivers it in a way that feels analogous, I think, to Christopher Nolan making an epic Hollywood movie.
How do you think the language changes the cadence, I guess, in some ways?
Well, you know, Emily Wilson preserves the custom of translating into English iambic pentameter.
Okay.
So the line still is five beats. But it's very conversational.
Yep.
And, you know, there are lots of examples that I could give, but, you know, then we'd be on another kind of podcast.
We'd be reading poetry to each other, Nate. Let's not do that.
But yeah, highly, highly recommend Emily Wilson's The Odyssey. And if you start now, you might even be able to blaze your way through it before Christopher Nolan's movie opens.
All right. Well, since we're talking about language, I'm actually going to turn my dig over to our producer, so that he can describe someone who he kind of looks like, actually, and I jokingly refer to as Lauren Ipsum, because...
Oh, okay.
Alex, you put me on the spot.
You are all digging right. This, and you got to cop to it, man. Come on.
I will cop to it. Yeah. I had a list of other things I'm digging, too, so because I rarely get the mic, I just need to shout out a few things before I dive into Lauren.
All right.
Henry Solomon. You guys hip to Henry Solomon?
No. I know that name.
Saxophonist, woodwind player.
All right.
He's got a new, speaking of solo albums, of woodwinds or of brass, and he has a new solo album called Solo Woodwind. Killer Barry sax player, woodwind bass clarinetist. Really interesting solo record. And Ben Phlox's record, Moonshades, another saxophonist. I'm putting saxophonist on blast. And I'm just coming off a Louis Armstrong kick, because I just produced this Louis Armstrong special for the Late Set Radio Hour, which I hope everyone here is listening to. And in doing my research, I came across this song, Don't Play Me Cheap. And I don't know what it was about it, but it gave me chills. Do you guys know this one?
I do.
What's the year on that?
33.
Okay.
There's something about his singing on this song that just made me want to cry.
He was very much on the cusp of stardom at that point.
Yeah, he's very young. I mean, he's young. But I'm just going to needle drop a little bit of that right
Please.
Here.
Yeah.
So people can hear just the way his phrasing when he's singing, it just is gutting.
Baby, don't you play me cheap. I may have a heap of that thing called money, honey. Wouldn't you feel disappointed if it's true? Don't you play me cheap, because I look so meek. I might be the brown-skinned daddy that could go for you in a great big way. Don't you think I'm sleeping when your wife's crying? I play the game and I know it well. Can't you pull a fast one on anybody? But be going behind my back. Don't you play me cheap. Don't you make no greed. Oh, real gun bumbling. Don't you play me. Oh, baby, that's who's either.
All right, now that you've played this, Alex, you have really set up the next person, because you played Louis Armstrong, who has invented his own language.
There you go. So there is a little tee up. Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce, I guess it's Benedict. Lauren Benedict.
Yeah.
Came across my Instagram feed, as a lot of my music discovery is, just from like friends sharing things, and now I'm going to needle drop this guy. Lauren Benedict, here he is scatting alone in his apartment in a blank walled room, and just, actually no, I'll drop him scatting in his bathroom because the acoustics are better. Here's Lauren Benedict scatting solo.
Move a thing for Wong, hin first. Five feather wong, who feather first. One wind out. Thu vadu fief and the weavers evened even you have in the window wong, who fin thin bitst. Feather von wong hoot. But feathy, feather high feather who rubble the wong when harbour over will believe in you have in the will belip fin stoot. Man fin dream and you have in the window.
Normally, scatting in your bathroom has a different context.
Yeah, this gentleman is on to something. I don't know much about him. I know that he's been doing this for quite some time.
It's deeply thoughtful, and actually.
I
just don't understand.
I don't understand it either. I'm perplexed by his choices of syllables, also his intonation, and the fact that he is not just doing gibberish out of tune. Like, he's actually hitting pitches, and he's actually dealing.
Yeah, well, he's using that sort of language to sort of make up for the way that he sings. There's a particular way, and I think he was describing this to somebody in the back of a car at some point.
Yeah, he just recently did an interview.
And
in the back of a Waymo.
Yeah, there you go.
He did an interview.
Is that from the KQED story?
Yeah.
So this is a piece by my friend and colleague, Andrew Gilbert, and the headline kind of says it: the most surreal jazz singer in the Bay Area today.
Yeah.
I would argue in the country. I've never heard anybody dealing a cappella scat, too. Like, the thing is, like, hearing him with a band or hearing him with another musician is fine and dandy, but the true effect is these solo improvisations where he's dealing with the harmony, he's dealing solo a cappella. I mean, no one's really blown me away like this since Bobby McFerrin, frankly. The captivating me, and just the surprise and the not knowing what's coming next with Lauren.
All right.
Would I put on a whole Lauren record? I don't know. But I would sure as hell go to like a master class, like if he was doing a lecture or something like that. And apparently came out of the Steve Coleman school I was reading too in the KQED article.
He approaches this so honestly, and I think so many of the cats who have experienced his work, they appreciate what he's doing as something that is ultimately one of one, mm-hmm. which is kind of a part of this, you know, adventure as an artist and a creator. And he has certainly found, I mean, I say it as a joke, Lauren Ipsum, but, you know, he's found his own language, and, you know, it is sort of like hearing Lorem Ipsum, you know, in some ways. But also, there is a real musicality to it, as you have recognized, Alex. And that's why I ask you to dig this.
If you go to his website and you go to press,
yeah,
he has one quote on there from Michael Shanley from Jazz Times.
Yeah.
Annoying wordless vocals.
Ooh.
This is rough. Lauren's own website.
Sure.
This is his own, like.
Well, I love that.
I love that too.
It doesn't matter what anybody says. This is what I'm pursuing. And he has done that.
Yeah. He's committed.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Enjoy this podcast? Of course you are. Leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice, and be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. Our handle is WRTI Music. Our email is editor@WRTI.org. That goes right to me. Be nice.
Our show is hosted by Nate Chenin. You just heard him. And me. You just heard me. The show is produced by Alex Arif, and you even heard Alex. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. He mixed this episode. Jacob Dodd was our production assistant.
The interview was recorded at Solar Myth by Bo Gordon. It was presented by our friends at Ars Nova Workshop. Shout out to Mark Christman. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we've got cooking up here in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.